Beyond Book Lecture. My name is Bill Scorsese and I'm the University Librarian. The Beyond the Book Lecture series is offered by the library as a venue for faculty and others to share their research. Today's lecture was organized to coincide with the Saskatchewan Archives Week, an annual initiative to raise public understanding of archives and their fascinating collections. Archives hold our collective memory, and the research resources makes lectures like ours today possible. After today's presentation, there will be time for questions, and then our university archivist, Mark Weichner, will introduce you to Saskatchewan's Visual Arts, a new and innovative online collection comprising archival photographs, documents, and resource links exploring our province's contribution to the visual arts. I would also like to invite you to join us for a small reception just outside the entrance to this room. I am pleased to introduce today's speaker, Timothy Long. Timothy is the head curator at the Mackenzie Art Gallery, where he has worked for the last 23 years, 12 of them in his current role. He is a graduate of the University of Regina and the State University of New York at Stony Brook. His interest in mimetic theory and the place of the viewer has resulted in a series of exhibitions, including Let Me Be Your Mirror in 2007, Double Space in 2008, My Evil Twin in 2009, and After Presence in 2012. Timothy's other interests include interdisciplinary approaches to ceramics, film, dance, and performance art. Timothy will speak today about art movements in Regina, Saskatchewan, and London, Ontario. Both cities were home to significant artistic activity that took a regionalist stance in the 1960s and 70s. His presentation considers the common challenges and strategies of these movements as they took on established hierarchies and launched the careers of artists such as Greg Curnow, Jack Chambers, and Murray Favreau in London, and Joe Fafard, Victor Sikansky, and Marilyn Levine in Regina. Please join me in welcoming Timothy Long.
Thank you, William. Archivists and librarians are useful people to know. And a number of years ago, I was encouraged to visit the archives to see a recent donation to their collection of works by Regina ceramic artists. I think it was Shelley Sweeney who had me coming over here. And that visit to the archives, as those visits sometimes turn out, for any of you who've done archival research, they can be life-changing, career-changing moments, and this was certainly the case. The material which they had accessioned included artworks and studies by artists such as Victor Sikansky, who we see here, his piece Urbane Drain from 1975, and Bijou by David Thalberger from 1975. They weren't the things I was expecting to see in the archives. I just wanted to say how happy I am to hear that this area of the archives continues to grow and is now being made accessible on the library website to interested people everywhere. So excited by my visit, I proposed an exhibition of artworks and related objects that I had found in the archives. However, as I continued to think about the work I'd seen, I realized that the exhibition I had in mind was too small, that the history represented by these objects required a much fuller historical treatment. The eventual result was the exhibition Regina Clay, Worlds in the Making, featuring 14 ceramic artists and covering the decade of approximately 1965 to 75. Which saw an amazing explosion of sculptural clay practices in Regina. Now, from that time on, I have been known as that clay curator by some of my colleagues, a title I proudly bear, and all thanks to a visit to the archives. Now, because of timing issues, the exhibition opened not at the Mackenzie Art Gallery, as you might expect, but at Museum London in London, Ontario in 2004. It appeared the following year in Regina, then toured to Burlington and Kelowna, and it was eventually turned into a website, which you see here, that you can still visit as part of the Virtual Museum of Canada. And we were really thrilled last year to be able to extend this web exhibition for another 5 years. The accident of timing, which led to opening Regina Clay in London, was actually a very happy accident. Here was an opportunity for the work of Saskatchewan's first regionalist art movement, what I call Regina Clay, to be seen in the home of another earlier regionalist movement based in London, which we associate with such names as Greg Curnow, Jack Chambers, John Boyle, Murray Favreau, and Tony Urquhart. London and Regina are cities which share common regionalist histories, a fact which I want to explore in this lecture, which I've titled Regionalism in Regina and London, Parallels Along the 49th. Discussions of regionally based art movements tend to be just that, regionally based. As a result, connections and comparisons between developments in other parts of Canada are often left unexplored. And I think this is unfortunate, because an understanding of the similarities and differences, the shared challenges, can be very illuminating, especially as discussions of place in a post-regionalist, post-modern context take on greater importance. As my starting point for the lecture, I will be looking at three points of connection between the art scenes in Regina and London. The first connection I want to look at took place in 1964, when Ronald Bloor, director of the Mackenzie Art Gallery, became the first person to purchase a work by London artist Greg Curnow for a public art gallery collection. That work, which you see here, was titled Tall Girl When I Am Sad on Dundas Street. That's Dundas, London, not Dundas, Toronto. It's from 1961, and it touched off a controversy at the art gallery when the acquisitions committee, led by Dr. William Riddell, refused to authorize the purchase of this disgraceful painting. Bloor's response was to set up donation boxes in local restaurants, asking the good people of Regina to support the purchase of the tall girl. And they even did little mimeographed images of her on a tent card so that people could see what their money would be going towards. I think he raised about $100. The other 200 that he needed to purchase were chipped in by Jean Chuka, the owner of Jean's franchise of restaurants in the city. And for $300, there you go. A Greg Curnow enters a public art gallery. Now, Bloor is perhaps best known as one of the Regina Five, which had risen to prominence in the early 1960s as a group of abstract painters with strong ties to the New York School. We see a selection of their paintings here. You probably recognize them from your own Regina Five wall here at the university. On the top, Ron Bloor, Art MacKay, Ken Lockheed. On the bottom, Ted Godwin, who sadly passed away just recently, and Doug Morton. In 1963, just a year before the Curnow purchase of Tall Girl, New York critic Clement Greenberg had declared Saskatchewan to be New York's only rival. Bloor's spare monochromatic paintings announced a severe modernist aesthetic, but as a museum director, his vision was much more nationalistic. And in fact, he rejected Greenberg's overtures to the community here. And with the purchase of Tall Girl, London regionalism, a la Greg Curnow, arrived in Regina. And later that year, Bloor organized a two-man show of Curnow and Jack Chambers. The second point of connection occurred a year later, in 1965, when a young political science student named Alex Kelly moved to London to study at the University of Western Ontario. From 1959 to 1963, Kelly had studied at the university here and had become keenly interested in the artistic scene which had sprung up around the Regina Five and which included university students, professors, as well as government civil servants, musicians, and writers. When Kelly arrived in London, he carried a letter of introduction from Ron Bloor to Greg Curnow. And here we see a panel from Curnow's Cityscape, one of his most famous works. Kelly, who was also a pretty good jazz musician, soon met John Boyle, Jack Chambers, and Murray Favreau as well. And as Kelly recounts, quote, "When we arrived, Curnow was at the center of a controversy in London. Specifically, he and others were concerned that the London Public Library and Art Museum was reluctant to show local work and seemed to disdain anything of recent origin. They knew of the situation in Regina and of the success of Mackay and others, and were determined to achieve the same degree of acceptance and support in London. In October 1965, I attended a public meeting where I spoke at length about the Regina situation. After the meeting, many wanted to know more about the arts in Regina and the role of the Norman Mackenzie Art Gallery." Essentially, Kelly's point was, you don't have to be a big city to have a significant art scene. If we can do it in Regina, a city of 50,000 at the time, you can do it in London. Of course, there was a world of difference between the modernist painting going on in Regina with its annual summer embrace of the New York art world via the MLA artists' workshops, and the assortment of pop and figurative work that was happening in London. But that didn't matter, and Kelly became a regular at gatherings at the York Hotel, where he happily chipped in with his jazz piano. So the third point of connection I'm going to look at took place nearly a decade later in, of all places, Paris, France. No, that's not Las Vegas. No, that's Paris. Canada Trajectoire 73 was an exhibition undertaken by the Musée d'Art Moderne de la Ville de Paris with the assistance of the Canada Council. It represented an attempt to show, quote, "the other slope of Canadian art to a French public more familiar with Canadian abstractionists like Jean-Paul Riopel and the Montreal school. The exhibition was divided into five sections: painting and sculpture, film, video, artists' groups, and, with a section all to themselves, Regina ceramists. Now, among the painters and sculptors, there was a substantial representation from London, Ontario. John Boyle, actually from St. Catharines, we see her here at the top with his painting Yankee Go Home. Murray Favreau at the bottom left with his projection installation Van Gogh's Room. And Don Bonham were the three from London. And also included in the film section was Jack Chambers, his classic film The Heart of London. And we see at bottom right his painting 401 Towards London Number 1 from 1968. The Regina ceramists included Victor Sikansky, Joe Fafard, and by the way, this photograph is actually taken at the entrance to the Musée d'Art Moderne de la Ville de Paris, and I can only imagine what's going through the mind of the gallery attendant. And David Gilhooly, who by this time had actually moved to Aurora, Ontario, and was teaching at York University. And James, and Marilyn Levine. And Russell Euricity, seen here in his self-portrait Aries from 1973, one of the works included in Trajectoire. The exhibition offered a fascinating picture of the regional trends in painting and sculpture, as well as emerging film and video practices, and the work of collectives such as Image Bank and General Idea. It was quite a mix. The exhibition was interesting from another perspective. Exhibition curator for the Musée d'Art Moderne, and the future director of the musée, actually, Suzanne Paget, noted in the catalog that the work is, quote, "profoundly and authentically rooted in the artist's sociological environment, a fact which gives rise to an art that knows how to be regional without ever being provincial." She goes on to discuss the work of Manitoba artists like Don Proche and Esther Warkoff, Ontario artist John Boyle, Newfoundland's Christopher Pratt, and sculptors Marie Favreau and John McGregor in this vein. But if you look But if you look at the catalog, the Regina contingent is left out of that discussion, even though its composition is obviously regionalist in its composition and content. And yet she manages to reserve a little separate category for them and describes them, I think, somewhat dismissively as having a naivete that is rustic and piquant. So French. Rustic and piquant. But anyway, so that was, I think, an unfortunate assessment of their work. And if you look at this page from the catalog, featuring the work of Victor Sikansky, the caption reads, "Oui, l'art est le prolongement de jeu," or "Yes, art is a continuation of play." Now, I think you get a sense of how seriously they were treating the Regina ceramists. This situation is repeated in discussions of Regina ceramics for years to come, as a movement considered in isolation from the rest of Canada. Hence my title, Regionalism and Regina, in Regina and London Parallels along the 49th. For these regionalisms are parallels in the true sense of the word, in that they are movements traveling in the same direction that never meet. Despite the fact that London and Regina knew about each other, and in fact had some direct links, including exchanges of exhibitions, which I haven't mentioned here, the London regionalists, seen here in their in the guise of the Nihilist Spasm Band, which still performs to this day in London. Fourth from the left is Murray Favreau, and John Boyle second from the right, and on the end, on the right, is Greg Curno. I actually went to hear them as I was doing some research for another exhibition. I just have one word of advice. If you're going to hear them play, bring earplugs. It's at a pain threshold that they're playing. And most of them are now profoundly deaf. But interesting group of artists and other people who also had a very interesting conception of musical improvisation. So what I want to talk about is to discuss some of those parallels and speculate as to why these parallel regionalisms never meet. What are the sympathies between Regina and London? Ross Woodman's 1967 Arts Canada article, London, A New Regionalism, lists at least six aspects of the London scene which can be directly applied to the Regina ceramists. The definition of regionalism as a rejection of the New York school, the catalyst of nihilism, the adaptation of international artists in local terms, the importance of childhood perceptions, the importance of travel and then return to your hometown, and the use of nostalgia toys, to use Woodman's term. I'll use these points as a kind of a reference guide for my comparison. But before doing that, I should just do a quick tour of how ceramics got started in Regina in the first place. The answer to that question is that it did not occur overnight, but can be traced to developments at the beginning of the 1950s. At that time, Nora McCullough of the Saskatchewan Arts Board was beginning to encourage the growth of pottery as a cottage industry in the province. And one of the ceramists she initially hired was Patricia Weems, who later became one of the first pottery instructors at the University of Saskatchewan Regina campus in the mid-50s. On the screen is a 1972 photograph of pottery instruction in the university's Department of Extension programs, which ran highly popular non-credit ceramic classes. Marilyn Levine, who was an instructor for many years, appears second from the right. It was at the university that Weens and her successor Beth Hone, who we see here, helped establish pottery as part of the art school curriculum, despite the opinion of director Kenneth Lockheed, who felt it was little more than craft. Outside the university, a young painter, Lorraine Malick, began creating ceramic murals for ecclesiastical commissions as early as 1961, and you can see her work here at Campion College. Thus, in 1964, when a 22-year-old California artist, Ricardo Gomez, was hired to set up the sculpture program at the university, an interest in ceramics was already in the air. Although he was moving away from clay in his own practice, he brought with him connections to the vital San Francisco Bay Area scene, where ceramic sculptors had severed the connection between clay and functional pottery. And for those students who felt constrained by producing copies of Scandinavian or Asian stoneware vessels, an alternative was finally at hand. Interest in clay was further stimulated when Jack Sears from Winnipeg was hired the following year to set up the ceramics program. Here's Jack without a beard. One of the few photographs that you'll see like that. A potter of exceptional skill, Jack taught a functional approach to ceramics, but he was open to experiments with sculptural form in both his own work and that of his students. As craft historian Sandra Alfody observes, from its inception in the 60s, the university ceramics department was an interdisciplinary endeavor. Through Sears and Gomez, a talented group of students, including future colleagues Marilyn Levine, Victor Sikansky, and Ann James, absorbed the lessons of functional pottery, but were encouraged as well to explore clay's sculptural potential. So by the mid-60s, Regina had the makings of a dynamic ceramics department. But there's nothing in this that challenges the modernist outlook of the department. Gomez, despite his California connections, is essentially a formalist, as seen in his 1962 clay and leather sculpture, which he created before leaving California. Sears' approach is rooted in a variety of sources, including Japanese ceramics, which was reinforced by a trip to Japan in 66, the legacy of European surrealism, and modernism. And he still describes himself as a modernist to this day. On the left of his example of his work on the wheel, and on the right, his untitled box from 1968, which I like to describe as a pot being squeezed by a sculpture. So what turned Regina ceramics into a regionalist movement? Here I'd like to return to Ross Woodman's analysis of London regionalism, in which he makes two very salient observations. First, Woodman defines regionalism as a movement away from the New York school, particularly, quote, the reduction of subject matter to style, and a movement toward the reintroduction of subjective experience. As he writes, they, the artists, reach beyond art into life to construct in their work ambiguous images that belong ultimately to neither. This is a useful definition of regionalism in that it shifts the focus away from the particularities of subject matter toward a more general description of an underlying shift from modernism to postmodernism, signaled in the rejection of universals and the embrace of the particularities of place. Second, Woodman notes the importance of the adaptation of international artists in local terms. He writes, Kernow, who we see here in his work from 1967, Kamikaze, Kernow is not opposed to any international school. He is opposed to the imitation of it before we have experienced it ourselves. Kernow and the other London regionalists paint as if a Larry Rivers or a Klaus Oldenburg lived in our society. This observation points toward the significant role that American pop artists played as catalysts for a rejection of New York school minimalism. Back to Regina. So here we have a tale of two competing visions of contemporary art. And on display right now is an exhibition on that theme, which I've installed as a complement to the current faculty exhibition. So here at the university, we have the Regina Five, and they and their contemporaries have established through the 60s an art school with an approach and a belief in an internationalist outlook and a modernist set of higher cultural beliefs, an outlook not seriously challenged by the hiring of Gomez and Sears. As time wore on, resentment toward this dominant position grew among students and newer faculty. By the end of the 60s, it was not New York pop but California Ceramics that was to provide an important catalyst for developments in Regina. Earlier in the decade, the West Coast funk aesthetic, with its affinity for bad taste, personal narrative, found object assemblage, and surrealism, had emerged as an important alternative to New York-style modernism. And I'm still amazed that to this date that Regina received a glimpse of this aesthetic in 1966 when the exhibition Edward Keenholz, Assemblages and Tableaus, 1957 and 1966, appeared at the Norman Mackenzie Art Gallery just a month after it made its debut in Los Angeles. So here we are, Regina, right at the epicenter of new developments in contemporary art. And here we have the work, one of the iconic works from Keenholz's oeuvre, his Backseat Dodge 38, which is now in the collection of the LA County Museum of Art. And that was one of the central pieces in the Regina show. Though not made of ceramic, Keenholz's socially charged assemblages provided an important model for Ann James' figurative work in clay and rigid polyurethane foam, such as this 1969-70 work, I'm Roberta, I'm Bettina. Greater importance, especially to other ceramic students, was Gomez's first-hand knowledge of the California scene. Whether the abstract expressionist ceramics of Peter Volkas, seen at the top left, the funk ceramics of James Melcher, bottom left, or the California fetish finish work of Ron Nagel at the right. It was not long before connections between Regina and California were strengthened by travel in both directions. In 1967, Victor Sikansky met Robert Arneson, a central figure among California funk ceramists. Here we see Arneson's Smorgy Bob, the cook, from 1971. Arneson encouraged Sikansky to continue his studies at the University of California, Davis, a place where Sikansky, in his words, would experience, quote, total freedom of materials, ideas, and attitudes. Offbeat works such as his all-clay picnic table, The Last Picnic, offer a foretaste of his later ceramic sculptures. By the way, the KFC bucket is real, not ceramic. I think the dogs are real, too. But the stump that you see the two Coke cans sitting on is ceramic, and that's in the collection of the Mackenzie Art Gallery now. Meanwhile, in Regina, the Mackenzie Art Gallery took advantage of Gomez's contacts and presented in 1969 the exhibition California Ceramics, Richard Shaw, Michael Frimkus, David Gilhooly, James Melcher, which exposed the community directly to the funk side of California's clay scene. The essay for the exhibition catalog was written by Jack Serves, giving an indication of the support in the ceramics department for new sculptural approaches to clay. Top left, we have Richard Shaw's airmail construction. Bottom left, Melchert's game number 3. And at right, David Gilhooly's Dave and Maya in front of Rainbow House. The Hone James Studio, which was set up a year earlier by Beth Hone and Ann James to provide additional studio facilities for a growing ceramics community, invited Melcher to give a workshop in conjunction with the exhibition. This is the photograph used to promote the workshop, showing left to right Bud McKee, Peter Volkas, Ron Nagel, and James Melcher, an all-star lineup out of the California clay scene. Marilyn Levine, in particular, benefited from the workshop. She produced for one of the assignments a meticulously fashioned clay shoe, an object which foreshadowed her later super realist renderings of leather articles. By the way, she was only able to complete one shoe during the workshop, and so at the end of the workshop, they were all asked to display her work. So very hastily, she made the tip of a crutch to put beside it. Levine, who had earlier made an extended trip to the studios of leading West Coast sculptural ceramists, started graduate school at the University of California, Berkeley in 1969, where she studied with Melchert and Volkas. Just as Sikansky had in Davis, Levine discovered in Berkeley an environment which stimulated the evolution of her own distinctive approach. Here we see her 1971 MFA graduating exhibition at the University Art Museum, Berkeley. So in 1969, when American artist David Gilhooly accepted an invitation to teach in Regina, the conditions were ripe for a ceramic revolution. Gilhooly, who had been among the first students of Robert Arneson at UC Davis, and who had been included in the 1967 Funk exhibition at UC Berkeley, brought with him an irreverent, anti-institutional outlook on life and art. It was in Regina that Gilhooly began to realize that the frog figures, which he had been creating on and off since Davis, could be developed into a full-fledged parallel frog world. Here we see a page from his sketchbook with a drawing for his frog world vision of Titian's Bacchanal. And those are, by the way, in the archives at the Nickel Arts Museum, University of Calgary. So we're talking about archives and their importance. Soon Gilhooly was creating everything from tableau top casseroles like this 1970 Pilgrim Frogs to his bust of famous figures, including his unforgettable frog Queen Victoria's. Clay, especially the white clay of the hobbyist, was more than just a medium for creating pottery mugs or bric-a-brac. Out of this stuff, you could create entire worlds. Gilhooly's overturning of the tables in the modernist temple of art had an immediate impact, especially on fellow faculty member Joe Fafard, who had been hired a year earlier. Inspired by Gilhooly's attitude that art should be personally meaningful and fun, Fafard abandoned the minimal kinetic sculptures of his graduate days at Penn State and began to make a series of plaster busts of his fellow professors, a rogues gallery, which he unveiled before an unsuspecting art department in January 1970. This is the head of Ted Godwin, one of the Regina Five, and the principal antagonist when it came to challenging the authority of modernist dogma. The tartan on the base of the sculpture is a wry reference to Godwin's tartan series and his nickname, the Tartan Kid. That green line going down his nose is just wicked. Now, I think a comparison between Gilhooly and Curnow is interesting here. Both were nihilists. Both shared a profound suspicion of art with a capital A. And both were catalytic for creating a sense of community among artists who shared this distrust of outsiders' opinions and judgments as to what counted in art. Fafard followed his bust with a series of half-scale standing figures made out of plaster. Here's his portrait of fellow faculty member Russ Uristi. For the next 2 years, Fafard continued creating caricatures, launching satirical barbs at the entire Regina art community in plaster and clay. Fafard appears in this invitation to his exhibition at the Dunlop Art Gallery as the small nude figure in the lower left and in the upper left and lower right. Yeah, that's Joe there. You can tell because he's got the squiggly hair. Fafard's figures became increasingly elaborate. Portrait of art historian David Zack is one of his infamous Four Horsemen, in which local artists and critics are mounted on phallic rocking horse steeds. In addition to his caricatures, Fafard voiced criticism of what he perceived was an excessive reliance on imported styles and opinions, stating, "We should abolish the reverence that we have for outsiders just because they are outsiders or because they are making it on the New York scene." Ideological differences and personality clashes reached a flashpoint over teaching and grading practices, with the newer faculty being accused of a total disregard for traditional academic discipline. Sure, you all get A's. That was Gihouli's approach. Gihouli's teaching position was not renewed for the 1971-72 academic year. Isolated but defiant, Fafard held on for another 3 years before resigning. By 1973, it was evident that a new sensibility had emerged in Regina that was unlike anything else anywhere in Canada. Here was a group of artists who had rejected the serious modernist enterprise of uncovering abstract universal truths in favor of a playful, if at times ironic, exploration of local realities. It was on this basis that their relationship to place, that the Regina ceramists were included in Canada Trajectoire 73, which I've already mentioned. Now, it's with regard to this relation treatment of place that further parallels to London can be drawn. Whitman notes two important points. The first is the importance of travel and return. Whitman describes the shaping influence of Jack Chambers' trip to Spain, where he lived for 8 years. There, Chambers realized that the Castilian landscape would always be impenetrable to him. When he returned to London, Ontario, Chambers realized that this was the place where his quest for self could be realized, a place with rich deposits of memory and experience. And here we see his famous painting Toward London on the 401. You might add Curnow's 1965 trip to New York, where he witnessed the mugging of his friend Les Levine, and which confirmed his anti-American sentiments, or Tony Urquhart's trip to France in 63-64, where he saw rentables, which were to inspire his movable boxes, which he began in 67. It's maybe a bit of more of a stretch, but Whitman connects Murray Favreau's inventions, such as this self-propelling propeller, to a childhood fascination with machines and to the cultural memory of Southern Ontario's history of craftsmanship. And by the way, this drawing is on display right now at McKenzie as part of Big Bang Theory. The Regina artists, especially Fafard, Sakansky, Uristi, and Thalberger, share stories of travel and return, though in their cases the starting point is in the rural and immigrant communities of Saskatchewan, and the travel is primarily to graduate schools in the United States, from which they return to Regina to teach and create art, and eventually re-engage with the milieu of their upbringing. Here we see Victor Sakansky's Saskatchewan Plate, 1969, made while he was still in Davis. And you can read on there, wow, real groovy country, Saskatchewan. When I think of Saskatchewan Plate, I think of bushwhackers, but that's something else. Joe Fafard grew up on a farm near the small Francescois community of Saint-Marthe in southeastern Saskatchewan. As we have already seen, he attended Penn State, where he investigated minimalism and kinetic art. His return to teach at the university and his friendship with Gihouli sparked a desire to break with modernism. And after 2 years of producing caricatures, he was asked to do a portrait of the father of one of the janitors at the university. Michael Haney was 107 years old, and doing this portrait pointed to an approach to sculpture that moved beyond caricature to real portraiture, from satire to a memorializing of the past, a key moment in his development. And this led to family portraits such as Mon Père from 1972, which the artist did shortly after his father's death. So that's Michael Haney on the left and Mon Père on the right. Fafard also began to do portraits of the residents of Pence, Saskatchewan, a small community where he had moved in 1971. This is Ford from 1976. It was around this time that he also began to work on cows based on childhood memories of the farm. Here we have Cow Giving Birth from 1971. And I didn't show you bloated cow impaled on a fence post. This is enough. Victor Sikansky grew up on the east end of Regina, an area populated primarily by Eastern European immigrants and referred to locally as the Garlic Flats, or Germantown. Despite its urban setting, the neighborhood had a semi-agricultural feel, as many residents, including Sikansky's grandmother, kept large gardens in which they grew much of their own food. An interest in food appears early in Sikansky's work, as we see in this zippered casserole from around 1968. Sikansky, as we've seen, eventually studied at Davis, where he absorbed a funk atmosphere. But even there, he found echoes of home. Ramshackle cabins in the Russian River area of Northern California inspired his last picnic scene here, reminding him of the backyard sheds and outhouses of his old neighborhood in Regina. After he returned in 1970 to take a position teaching art education at the university, it was not long before he began to explore the subject matter of his youth. In 1974, he moved to Craven, where he converted his school into a studio. This is Prairie Waterworks from 1973. Russ Yuricity grew up on a farm in a predominantly Ukrainian district of East Central Saskatchewan. His graduate schooling took him to the University of Wisconsin in Madison, where he developed a pop idiom in painting and printmaking. He continued in this vein after his return to Saskatchewan to teach at the U of R, but in 1971 he moved to the small town of Silton, the same year that he was let go by the university. There he began to create drawings that feature funky animal shelters. These provisional constructions speak of a desire for home that is at less of a remove from nature, though still the work of human hands. An expression of the Back to the Land movement, which had led Yuricity, Fafard, and Sikansky to take up residence in small rural villages. Yuricity was introduced to clay by Fafard in 72 and continued to create images that went deeper into his childhood experiences and explored the vernacular imagery of the prairies. This is Horson Open Cutter from 1974, and the figures in the cutter are Yuricity's parents. Other works explore the vernacular image of the prairies. The story of Western settlement is encapsulated on the label of this popular Western Canadian beer. I had to explain that when I was giving this lecture in London, Ontario, but I don't think I need to. It's a pill. David Thalberger grew up in the small farming community of Holdfast. He began his schooling at the University of Regina, but grew disillusioned with modernist dogma. Gahuli's arrival convinced him to return to school and begin to work in clay. Thalberger went on to school in California at Sacramento State University and later at the University of Montana in Missoula, where he studied with Rudy Audio. Thalberger returned to Regina and continued to work in ceramic, producing work in a funk pop idiom, such as this biker trophy, Evil Knievel Jumps Snake River Canyon from 1973. However, it wasn't until he started to look at the work of folk artists that he began to realize the significance of his locality. As he observed, small town culture in rural Saskatchewan is every bit as exotic as outlaw biker culture in Chicago. On the left, you have Jan Weyer's These Good Old Thrashing Days, a work, by the way, which was purchased for the Mackenzie by Ron Bloor over a decade earlier. And on the right is W.C. McCarger's Untitled Prairie Landscape from around 1960. The insight provided by folk artists led him to create his first local buildings, such as a Volkswagen piece from 1974. And eventually the false front hotels and theaters, such as the Grand from 1975 and the Bijou, which I showed you earlier. These latter works were the springboard for Thalberger's paintings, for which he's better known. Now I think What is interesting here is a journey that is reflected in their work, giving the artists a double sense of place. In their work, place is intimately linked to a history rooted in memory, but that history is expressed neither as the modernist triumph of progress, the erasure of local memory, nor as a nostalgic retreat into an idealized past, the refusal of modernity, but as a complex accommodation between the two poles. There is what may be called a double vision, a term which critic Nancy Towsley later applied to the paintings of David Thauberger, to describe an awareness that is, quote, cosmopolitan and regional at the same time. However, the wider cultural preoccupations of the time tipped the reception of the work in favor of the pole of nostalgia. While the artist's connections to region resonated with the art world's emerging postmodern concern for place, it also struck a chord with the popular imagination at a moment when the Back to the Land movement was at its zenith. A notable example of this popular interest is the 1973 National Film Board documentary on Fafard, I Don't Have to Work That Big, which played up Fafard's personal connection to the small town of Pence, where he had lived since 1971, and whose residents had become subjects for his sculpture. Here's one of the promotional photographs for that film. Interestingly, the makers of the film had commissioned a photographer to follow Fafard and his colleagues in Paris and document their encounter with Europe's great art capital. However, the final cut of the film excluded any reference to the exhibition or, for that matter, to any of Fafard's art world connections or influences. As a result of the NFB documentary and other portrayals of the Regina artists, especially Sikansky, Uristi, and Thauberger, many have viewed their work as a straightforward, nostalgic celebration of rural life. However, this view does not do justice to the complexity of their creative vision. As I've mentioned, there's a double perspective on place that is encoded physically in the work. To give one example, Victor Sikansky's sculptures from the years 1972 to 1975 offer a riotous marriage of high and low culture that results from the fusion of images from childhood memory, such as the outhouses of the Garlic Flats, with art world references, such as Greek temples in this piece, Singing the Joys of an Agrarian Society from 1972. And I'll leave it to your imagination what's oozing out of the bottom of that outhouse. It's art. In these works, life-sized rocks, plastic flowers, and ceramic decals are set within a miniature world, creating shifts of scale. In most cases, the spaces are opened up, cut away, and exposed to the viewer, who is in turn drawn inside, as in Moose Jaw Woman of 1974. High and low, big and little, inside and outside, doubleness is coded on a number of levels in these works, speaking of an experience of place that is engaged with local realities, but always with an awareness of larger frames of reference. The incongruence of these different frameworks results in a wry prairie humor, which is uniquely Sikansky's. And that those observations about dual perspective can be multiplied throughout the work of the other artists. For instance, in Joe Fafard's early portraits of his father and other family members, he was also looking at Benin bronzes that were being exhibited at that time. Euricity, similarly, he finds a tension between a rooted regional identity and a restless mobility in works such as Boys on Christoph's Truck. And Thauberger's false front buildings epitomize the contrast between local reality, as expressed in the false fronts, and the wider world which becomes available through popular media such as film. Might also mention the work of Lauren Boyg, an artist who took classes with Fafard and Levine, and who created a body of work which draws on an interest in anthropology and the physical sciences, as in Architectana Perspectiva from 1976. Even Jack Sears, who was by no means a regionalist, began in the 70s to show an interest in place in works such as Two Meanies on a Mountain on the left, and on the right, Near Elle's Place from 1975. Elle's Place, of course, refers to the potash mines which the NDP government of Alan Blakeney expropriated in the 1970s, a rare political reference from Sears, and an equally rare depiction of cows in his work. Now, up to this point, I've focused mainly on the male artists, typically associated with Regina ceramics, and have outlined a number of parallels to London-based painters and sculptors. One key difference between London and Regina, though, is the higher proportion of women artists involved in the Regina scene. The only woman in the Heart of London exhibition was actually Bev Kelly, Alex Kelly's then partner, who had come to London from Regina with her husband. In the current exhibition Regina Clay, 6 of the 14 artists are female. I think this has a lot to do with the pottery subculture, which was predominantly female. Pottery gave a way in for women artists. It's somewhat surprising then that gender issues have seldom been considered in relation to Regina ceramists. A closer look reveals subtle differences in approach between the male and female artists that I can just touch on briefly here, looking at the work of Anne James, seen here in a portrait by Joe Fafard. James, who was British born, was referred to affectionately as the godmother by the male artists who were the boys. She gained a reputation for her subversively ugly pots, such as this work titled Vase, Dalton Flower Group, and for her aggressively formed figures in ceramic and foam, through which she critiqued various forms of social hypocrisy. This is Lonely Girl from 1968, a comment on how women feel like they're being sat on, or how they feel on a hot day when you could just melt into a chair. James and the other women artists, though, refused the label of feminist, and perhaps that explains why they've not been discussed in that under that rubric. Here we have Calgary-born Marilyn Levine, who was attracting the attention of American dealers and curators for her super realist objects, including leather jackets, cups, bags, boots, and more boots. These are John's Mountie boots from 1973. For Levine, these personal objects were not so much about the objective surfaces of the photorealists, with whom she was often associated, but a means for exploring the subjective experience of time, as registered by the trace of wear produced by the human body. A current concern for the body is also found in the work of Margaret Keelan, who came to Regina from Saskatoon in 73 to study with Fafard, but who found a lasting mentor in Levine, whom she followed to Utah to continue her studies the following year. Her hybrid bird women point to the prevalence of animal imagery at the time, although in this case they were inflected with a distinctly feminine consciousness. An affinity to the feminist pattern and decoration movement can be found in the work of Maya Peoples-Bright, known in Regina as Maya Zack and later as Maya Wolf, a graduate of UC Davis, like Gihouli and Sikansky. In Regina, she began to combine fabric and ceramics in her crocheted woofishes, named in honor of her dachshund, Wolf, whose name she took after leaving husband David Zack. As she says today, I've always taken the name of the man I was sleeping with at the time. In this case, her dog, Woof. Sunny Snail's Woofish is from 1970 to 71. She also created in clay and paint wildly patterned animal fantasies based on alliterative titles such as this 1970 work, Peacock Peaks. In general, the regionalist themes that mark the work of the male artists are absent in the work of the women's ceramists. Despite this difference, male and female artists were often shown together in various combinations, a fact which points to a more basic unifying characteristic, personal narratives in clay. Given the Regina clay scene, that the Regina clay scene never developed into a movement with its own, with a formal manifesto or a defined membership, it's not surprising that interpretations of the movement did not give shape till its history until the end of the decade of the 1970s. Eli Mandel provided this in his article, A Comprehensible World, The World of Sikansky, Thauberger, Uricity, and Fafard, in which he probed the historical links between Regina and California clay. In 79, official recognition came to Malik, Sirs, and Sikansky in mural commissions for the provincial government's sturdy stone building in Saskatoon, the same year that Susan Whitney Gallery opened in Regina, providing an essential commercial outlet for many of the artists. By this time, however, much of the earlier momentum had been lost, especially in the university, with the departure of Levine in the mid-70s, along with Keelan, James, and Boyg. Uricity and Thauberger, by 1976, had both given up clay in favor of other media. Fafard and Sikansky continued to work in ceramics for another decade, but they too moved into other media, most notably bronze, in the mid-80s. Of the artists in this exhibition, Regina Clay, only Sirs provided continuity for ceramic practice in the University Art Department, where he remained on faculty until the 1990s. So what are the significant differences between London and Regina? The greater involvement of women is one, but the first and most obvious is the choice of material. In Regina, clay is both a medium and a message, an idea conveyed here in Joe Fafard's double portrait of Bob Arneson. As a fine art material, it was free from history and pretension, and offered a very versatile open canvas for exploration. The very choice of clay was a thumb in the nose to modernist ambitions. As we saw in the case of Trajectoires, the ceramists were as a result treated less seriously than artists working in the plastic mediums of painting and sculpture. Even sculpture as radically non-traditional as that of Marie Favreau. Clay was also a non-theoretical material, at least in Regina. And I think this also is part of the reason for its lack of critical attention. The one writer from the period who was contemporary with the developments in Regina was David Zach, who had known Gilhooly and Sikansky at UC Davis and came to Regina to teach art history. But his quick exit from the scene limited his effect. And yet, I think the work of the Regina Clay Movement is significant for its articulation of an aesthetic that is based in place and personal experience, an aesthetic that stands out as one of the early attempts at what you might call a cognitive mapping of the emerging postmodern world. Finally, there's the reality of geographical isolation that was felt, I think, more acutely in Regina than London, where Toronto and New York were both in close proximity. Here we see Vic Sikansky's mural, Regina, My World, which is installed in the Cooperators Building downtown. In this vision of his hometown, the only connection to the wider world is via the many Canada geese seen above the wheat fields encircling the city. On the one hand, Regina's isolation has meant an openness to outside ideas. Unlike London, artists in Regina of the 60s were receptive to New York. Resistance took time to develop. James Melchert's impression of Regina when he came for his 69 workshop was one of isolation. If they were going to create something, they would have to find energy from each other. That they did, as well as continue to embrace outside ideas, this time from California. These factors may be sufficient to account for the lack of connection between Regina and London, but I want to propose one more aspect which may have a bearing on this history, and that is regionalism's curious relationship to nationalism. Note that the exhibitions which have marked the defining moments of recognition for the various movements were all organized by federal institutions. It was the National Gallery of Canada which organized five painters from Regina, and the Heart of London, which occurred in 1967. And it was the Canada Council that was instrumental in the selection of the Regina ceramicists for Trajectoire in Paris. Ross Woodman, in his conclusion to his article, argues that, quote, "The childlike quality of the work of Curnow is a quality that underlines his recognition for the need for regional and personal roots as the basis for a national art. For Woodman and for many others, the regionalist agenda has ultimately been a nationalist one." Art historian David Howard has explored this topic extensively in his analysis of shifts in Canadian cultural policy during the 60s. His essential argument is that regionalism served the nationalist agenda of the Pearson and Trudeau administrations, who had adopted the pragmatic liberal cultural strategy that was initiated by the Kennedy administration. Regionalism, because of its anti-elitist and pluralistic emphasis, was promoted over and above the work of earlier modernist artists, which increasingly became identified with an elitism that was out of touch with mass culture and technologies. The work of London regionalists was seen as particularly valuable because it was regional without being provincial, and thus suitable for asserting Canada's cultural diversity and maturity on an international stage. So to conclude, these political considerations, which I've grossly oversimplified, have little to do with the perception of place that is at the heart of the artist's concerns, that cognitive mapping, which is the first step in understanding place in the context of global society. So long as the interest in identifying and promoting regional art is nationalist, communication between regions will always be mediated by the third term of Canadian culture. In other words, the 49th parallel has kept regions on parallel courses which never touch. Thank you.
Timothy's willing to take any questions, if there's any questions for him. Okay, well, thank you very much. As an archivist, it's really great to see the end product of archival research. It's always very, very thrilling.
Hit escape.
The end product of archival research. As Bill mentioned in his opening remarks, archives hold our collective memory, without which understanding the past and its impact on the present wouldn't be possible. While archives preserve, they also aim to increase access to archival resources. As part of that aim, I'd like to spend a few moments introducing you to Saskatchewan's visual arts, a new webpage that will ultimately greatly expand access to a large component of materials that we preserve at the university's archives and special collections. The slides behind me are drawn from over 3,700 that have been digitized as part of the first module of that webpage. That first module explores the work of artist Joe Fafard. Archives and Special Collections was first approached in 2005 about the possibility of digitizing the slide collection of Joe Fafard. The original concept proposed that the archives acquire and digitize Fafard's extensive slide collection as a step towards creating an online research center of his work. This online research center would allow for serious scholarship and was envisioned as envisioned as aggregating the digital materials of various archives galleries, and other institutions and individuals. Over the next several years, Fafar donated slides to Archives and Special Collections, which documented nearly his complete body of work from roughly the mid-1980s to 2002. Fafard's staff had maintained a series of logbooks that recorded all project details, such as the medium of the work, size, number of castings, and sales information. While the logbooks were not part of the archival donation, the information in them was recorded by archive staff and ultimately formed the basis of the slide descriptions that you'll find attached to each image on the website. The library's systems department undertook the digitization of the slides, producing a series of high-quality master images from which the images that you see here were then created. Afterwards, the technical services unit developed subject headings and keywords that make the digital collection easily navigatable. This was all thanks to archives, systems, and technical services staff, and in particular, Carol McDonald, Barbara Nelke, Larry McDonald, Johnson. The original concept called for an online research center. The slides the website presents are supplemented by resource links to a number of collections and other authoritative sites such as the National Gallery of Canada and the Centre for Contemporary Canadian Art. Resources are also available for various other artists whose materials are held by Archives and Special Collections and who will be the subject of future modules for the webpage. This lecture itself will soon be added to that webpage as a resource as well. The link to the webpage is printed on the cards that you will find on the tables around you. Please take one, explore the site, and visit it often. Once again, please join me in thanking our speaker, and thank you to all of you for attending today.